I'ma say what I feel, and I promise to keep it real.
Welcome to the Red Room. Well, you gotta be a rider till your fears are diminished and the doubts are behind ya. It's hard to grind and the business got me stressed in the rent room. We let that shit up off our chest. You know the street nerd has got no time for no caca. Sass in class, yes, that's Mr. Bolakaja. Never have to guess when you're listening to Hilliard. He gon' bring more game than a shark playing billiards. It's all about the crap of screenwriting. It's exciting when you turn an outline into something enlightening. Your pen and words are like bullets in a gun. Write what you feel, say what you want. Welcome to the Rant Room.
What's up, y'all? It's your boy, Hilliard Guest, and you guys are listening to the Screenwriters Rant Room, where we keep it real, we keep it opinionated, we keep it what y'all, Wakanda. On this show, we discuss entertainment, TV, film, music, culture, but our focus is always screenwriting, stories, craft, and shit like that. So a little disclaimer, Lisa Bolakaja is out yet again.
Damn it!
Janet.
Lisa, why are you avoiding me?
You know what I'm saying?
Are we going to put her now, like on a footnote now? Because it's like she's
co-host.
Yeah, because she's been on like three times all year. And here we are.
I blame myself.
I haven't seen her since I've been here.
Have you? She hasn't been on the it's June now.
At least three times, and maybe four.
No, she's only been here like four times all year.
Lisa, you better tip your ass back up to L.A.
After we've done 24 back. Episodes,
at
she's
least.
Done three.
At least.
That's like some Star Wars like number in terms of its quality. Output.
Okay. So we got my girl sitting in with us today, Lauren Warren from Nerds of Prey. What's going on, girl?
Not much.
It the other way.
Nerds of Prey!
Yeah, there we go.
You need to scoot up.
I need to scoot up. I will do that, sir. Thank you. I am well. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, well, how you been? What's going on now?
She just
moved to L.A., Jeff.
Yeah, I made the big drive 3 months ago. No, wait, 4 months ago.
Yeah, it's been a minute.
We're in June, Toronto.
Wow.
Yeah. Took 4 days, drove across with a friend, and because she and my husband were tired of me saying, I keep missing out on meetings. So they said, well, go.
You better tip your ass to LA, too.
He packed me up, and she helped me drive. So okay. I've been out here and I've been writing. I've been meeting a lot of people. I've never had so many lunches and coffees in my life.
That's how you're supposed to do it.
But I love coffee, and I love to eat. So, hey, it all works out
and
great.
They pay for the food mostly, right?
Who, me?
The other people.
Oh, the other people, yeah.
See?
Yeah.
That's the best part of our business.
Yes.
Exactly.
I hand out a card, I smile, I wave, I chat, and then, you know, hey, give me that email and I'll slide you something when I'm done.
So we got my man, of course, Chris Derrick in the house from the writing directing team, the Derrick Brothers. What's up, Chris Derrick?
Not much.
Yeah. Y'all nonchalant.
You feeling it's just
nothing.
Sunday, baby.
You feeling better today?
Finally.
Yeah, you were sick last time we talked.
Oh, the last 3 weeks.
Yikes.
Oh, no.
With what? Just whatever is going around.
He got the vapors. Fuck, you know.
The vapors. I mean, not 3 weeks, but it's been since like Thursday before Memorial Day. It's been a while.
That is about 3 weeks.
About 3 weeks.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
I hate being sick. That's why I rarely do.
Fevers and shit. It's just, you know, I think about when I was sick back east in the winter times, stuff like that. And it's okay to be cold. Or a fever when it's cold.
But out here.
But it's not because you're like doing like, do I got to put the AC on to keep it? Like, it's just a lot.
Frank and Annette keep trying to get me to the beach every day.
You know, exactly. it's just, I don't know. You know, it's just not good. And at night, it's just terrible. But I'm feeling better now. Finally, I'm back on trying to write a bunch of shit. I want to do that short, man, about the school thing.
That's bad. So. You got to tell Jeff about that later. That's a good one.
Oh, my God. Look on his face. I'm already terrified.
Thinking about it more.
Jeff said he'll produce it for you. You know,
it's simple. It's simple.
I'm Kurt. I can't even say that.
It's simple. I think you would really dig it. I think you'd be like, fuck that. Well, we'll talk about it.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. We'll get into it.
All the stuff you guys don't get to hear. That's the real tea.
Exactly. So we got our big bro in the house. The OG, the mentor himself.
Stop it.
The pimp dog.
Oh, yeah, right. My wife is already laughing. She's not even listening to this right now. She's heard in the mystic world.
Exactly.
Someone said something stupid about Jeff.
Jeff Thorne, writer, producer himself. What's going on, man?
What's up? a bunch of stuff. Almost all of it I cannot talk about for legal reasons. It's really upsetting. Working for Marvel is like working for, I don't even know, the mafia, right, or like some sort of weird secret ninja assassin organization. Well, like, what?
Let me just cut you off for a second. This is, it's, I mean, look, we were talking a little bit, and I know that you have a lot of things that you're under the wraps, but it's one of these things I always say to people, the analogy about when you're developing stuff is, it's Tesla versus Edison.
Yeah,
and you're all of Tesla. Us are Tesla. Yes, I'm saying we're like, all Tesla.
All of us are Tesla. Poor Tesla.
And the industry is Edison. I mean, like the big A-listers are Edison.
Yeah, okay. That's kind of true.
I mean, if I know what's up, you're done.
I'm working on a bunch of stuff, but they—I mean, it's not like they force you to sign. You sign the agreement, and the agreement is very specific about when and what you can talk about, which is nothing.
Nada. He's actually unemployed. He's on a bread line.
Yeah, I can't even say that.
He's on the bread line.
No, things are going pretty good. Things are going pretty good. I can tell you this. I can give you my assessment of whenever they decide to drop it. The upcoming Black Panther's Quest cartoon is like nothing you've seen from Marvel before.
Right. Awesome.
The team of us that made this thing, none of whom I can name yet.
Still can't even say who the writers are.
And they can't either. Not the writers. Jesus, not the. Christ. I mean, they announced James and Daisy as T'Challa and Shuri.
Right.
That's the list.
That's it.
I can't even tell you anything else. We got a lot of great guest stars coming in. We got some episodes you can't believe we even got on the air. Right.
The animation studio can't be discussed. Like, none of that stuff.
None of that. None of that. Now, there's a lot of people probably listening who can, with their own backstage connections, figure some of what is out. Mm-hmm. All I can tell you is, as the person who helped make it, the one of the guiding creative forces behind it, you're in for a treat. You're in for a treat.
Well, we're looking forward.
There's nothing embarrassing about it. Sure, there's nothing you're going to feel like, what? Like, there's a bunch of things you can't do that they can do in the movies, but it's not specific to our show.
Yeah.
It's just the way cartoons work versus the way a motion picture works.
Right.
So you're going to get three versions. At the end of the day, you're going to get a comic book version, a movie version, and a cartoon version, all Black Panther, all slightly different from one another.
Oh, just real quick. Speaking of difference between the live action films and the animated films, have you seen the trailer for the Spider-Man thing coming?
Dude, I tell you what, if somebody told me that you can stay in Hollywood, but all you can make is a movie like this or a TV show like this, I would already be kissing their boots. That movie, if that doesn't blow up like it can't be bad. There's literally no way. Even if every line of dialogue in the movie we've seen the trailer for is crap, it still is going to be like, oh my God, where have you been?
I mean, it's not just Miles, but they got Spider-Gwen in there. I was like, okay, hold on. Y'all doing it up.
Dude,
yeah.
But so, even just the visual, like, look, the difference between me and a lot of people who are practitioners is it starts turning into fiefdoms, right? I work only for Warners. I'm a DC dude. I'm a Marvel dude. I'm a whatever. I'm a dude who likes great shit, okay? That looks like if Pixar and Disney Animation don't have competition, they got some comp from Sony this year.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sony dropped the mic on that one. They came to play. Just like I felt when I saw the first How to Train Your Dragon, it was like a bunch of people on the other side in the other castle, they were like, oh, you think you have the field? No, you don't have the field. That's exactly what Sony finally did with this. And more power to them. I want them to win. I want How to Train Your Dragon 3 to come out and murder everybody else. I want all the great shit that I get to go see. I don't care what studio made it, unless
you know, I don't care. It's crazy. It's like I hear people all the time, they talk about when they were kids, they were either Marvel guys or DC guys.
Right.
And I was like, what the fuck is that shit? They're both good.
I'm a good story
guy. Read the
guy.
Good shit. Like, no matter who's writing the good stuff, read what's good. And there was a lot of good stuff both put out, and I never understood the...
I'm anti-squad, dude. I'm totally anti-squad.
The tribalism.
I'm out.
From way back then.
See what we got to deal with, Lauren?
I was team video game when it was coming up. So I didn't get into comics until much, much, much later. I was just team Nintendo, then team Xbox, and that's the only... team I stand for.
I know. That's a privileged children. The young people today, they don't understand.
Just Atari.
I'm not that young.
Just Atari. Just Atari.
Yeah.
Just like Atari. My system was Activision and Television.
Damn, girl.
Okay. So, yeah.
But I will say this. The console wars were legit.
Yeah.
Because even today, if you're holding a Nintendo controller, if you're holding an Xbox controller, if you're holding a PS4 controller, Some fit more naturally in some hands, some fit more naturally in other hands.
Yes.
I watched with dismay when people tried to move from Nintendo to the first Xbox, or was it Dreamcast or whatever?
Sega Dreamcast,
right,
yeah.
Where it was like you were holding it this way, and there was like 9,000 buttons on it.
And all these triggers
and people
shit.
Were like, what am I supposed to do? Mm-hmm. Like, just play the game, man. Just play the game. Shoot that thing. Shoot. Oh, God damn it. You know.
Mash them all. Mash
right.
all the
but
buttons.
But the Nintendo, yeah. the first Nintendo controller was like hyper simple. So.
I miss the old shit. It had a little thing.
But the joystick and a button.
But what I'm saying
is
console wars, those are legitimate factions. That's like, look, I don't like playing this game because it's hard to play this game.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's not like, I like Nintendo because Mario's my king. Right. You know?
Right.
But, you know, but it's like, I remember when we were kids, there was that thing between Atari and television because yep. television had that disc
right.
and the keypad.
Yep.
So people were like, I can't get that because I need the stick. And then ColecoVision came out.
Yep. ColecoVision.
Like with his own with his own controller with that little yeah. like with the little like swivel wheel, and I was like, oh, it's fucking up. And it was what's the other was it Commodore 64? Did they have some no that was something
no,
that, else.
Yeah. That was like a hand thing.
One of the first commercials I did shit. Was for TurboGrafx.
Oh yeah, oh, TurboGrafx wow. 16. Wow. TurboGrafx 16.
Wow.
Yeah. So what did
that
you settle?
Was cool.
Oh God, I have everything now still.
Really?
I have two original NESs. An Xbox 360, an Xbox One, a PlayStation, Nintendo 64, Super Nintendo still,
hardcore,
and a
Jack.
Power Glove.
All right, I'm going to have to check your geek, Craig, because girls can't play video games. I'm just
right.
telling
well,
you.
Let
girls
me take my earrings off. Hold yeah. on one second.
Go get them. Take my shoe off while I'm at it.
Where's
like,
my Vaseline,
goddammit?
I've been playing since I was like 5, and that was one of the things that when my husband and I were dating, I asked him about playing Halo, and he was like, what do you know about Halo? I was like, I know I could beat you.
Yeah, I'm about to school your ass. That's what I know.
So we still play together to this day. We still play.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and when we moved in together, we merged consoles. That was part of the whole, you know, get this, you get rid of this, and I'll get rid of this one, and yeah.
Geek love. Yeah. It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
It exists. Wild. It exists.
That's wild.
That's what's up. So if you guys are grown, let's go ahead and get into the show.
Here we go.
So today, we'll be getting some questions from, you know, listeners, and also, you know, we have my girl Lauren Warren in the house. And the last time you heard, we kind of did something a little bit similar where she just moved into town. So it was like a question on like, what's it like coming in a town, being from another, you know, she is from America, but, you know, living in Toronto, then coming here. And
my Canadian friends, when I was younger, I would always forget they were Canadian
right.
because they sound like us.
Exactly.
Right. That's the only country in the world that sounds exactly like the United States.
A little slight accent, depending on where you are.
Yeah, but if you've been to Chicago, the Canadian, a Toronto accent is actually easier to grasp.
Yeah.
So I would forget they were Canadians. I'm like, so where are you from? And they're like, Toronto,
North Dakota.
Vancouver. And I'm like, no, you're not, you know, whatever. So, but it is a culture shock, right? Mm-hmm. There is some culture shock when you come from another nation to this nation and you move from a normal city to Los Angeles, which is not a normal city because of the industry.
It wasn't the first time I'd ever moved. Like I was telling you how I've actually moved 18 times since I was 18.
Dear God.
For various reasons. Partly because my dad was in the military and then I would just sort of trail along with them.
Really? In 3 years, that's how much you've moved.
Thank you. Give him some candy, please.
Exactly.
But yeah, so it was, I had spent 5 years up there and was laid off and then transitioned into writing full time. So it was more of a culture shock, a corporate culture shock to go from corporate work to creative work that has no net. You know, there's no map. There's no measurements for anything. You know what I mean? So, and I was talking to another writer friend of mine last week, and I said, I find that I'm still struggling that I put corporate benchmarks on a creative process.
Yeah, don't
and
do
it
that.
Doesn't work.
It doesn't work at all.
It doesn't work. Right. You know,
let's give people an example of what you mean when you say that.
So, like, I've been here 4 months, and my type A personality says,
you're like, I'm gonna have an agent.
I should be working. Right. I should be this. I should be that. And I'm not those things. Mm-hmm. So I beat myself up for a while. Mm-hmm. And he said, let me assure you right now, you're doing all the right things. You just have to be patient.
Right. Yep.
And I was like, okay, but he says, there's no but.
Exactly.
There's no but. Put a period into that sentence. Right. There's no but. You just have to be patient. I was like, okay. Right. But am I doing all the right things? Yeah, you're doing all right. You're meeting me. You're meeting people. You're doing this. You're doing that. Just be patient, and all the puzzle pieces will come together. Right. So it's that you have 4 months to produce X amount of blah, blah, blah.
But being patient, people got to be careful with that, because they're like, well, just be patient.
No, it's tenacious.
So they think that means sitting back.
Oh, right. No.
It's like, no, bitch, work harder.
So I'm like, I'll just go
and
do
the patience
this
fucks with people. I mean, the waiting game is what fucks with people.
We'll never be waiting. I think that's the secret.
You have to maintain, do something while you wait.
Well, okay, this is what I mean by the waiting game. The waiting game is not you not doing anything, but I think what fucks with people is you're waiting for a response for something, and I think that you can avoid the anxiety of that by working on the next project.
Yes. I always tell baby writers and baby... newcomers is a better way to say it, because not everybody's a baby writer. Baby writer is a very specific term about when you join a show and you're the staff writer. Right. You could be 50 and everyone else could be 20 and you're still the baby.
On my show.
Right.
Then they're 50.
But you know what I'm saying? So, but there is a tendency with people to equate what you're saying, a kind of physical, easy to understand success and a sort of weird ladder and timetables that they apply to it based on what they've always known, because most people didn't grow up in the arts.
Correct.
They always wanted to be in the arts, but didn't really grow up in it.
Right.
So when they make that final switch, it's an upheaval. It is a leaving behind of all that I know. It's a leap of faith in a certain way. Right. And then you get here, and it really, really, really doesn't work that way.
You can't be taught it.
And you can
got to learn it.
And you can get sucked into the sitting around cafe culture of wannabes. Mm-hmm. Okay?
And I think
what... What you find when you talk to people who are getting somewhere, quote unquote, they got like 9 things going on.
Yeah.
And some of them don't even have anything to do with this industry.
Right.
They're writing messes or they're illustrating or they're making a film.
They're blogging,
or
they're doing whatever.
But they're doing a thing that gets them somewhere. And then you look back and go, all that added up to this.
Right.
But there's no plan, because there can't be. Right. Like, even now people are asking me questions about how to break in and all. I'm like, as soon as you break in, whatever you did to break in, they seal that door and lock it shut and weld it with a steel plate. No one is duplicating whatever the hell you did.
Nobody.
That's true. Yeah, it's funny because you read those stories. That's the thing that's sad, is that you read the stories of what people did and everyone thinks that's the
I'll do that.
That's the way that they... And it's, you're right. And it's like, it's sealed. There's no other... Like, they're not letting anyone else come in that way.
Picture a giant dam with a bunch of hairline cracks in it. And you're not close enough in Chicago to see even the cracks. You've got to move close to the dam, come to L.A.
Yeah.
Then you get here, it takes a minute to, oh my God, it's not... That's not as perfect as it looked like it was. Mm-hmm. It's got cracks in it. Mm-hmm. Now that crack, the first crack I see is way up at the top where Jeff Bridges lives. Right? I'm not getting to that crack because no one can scale the wall because they got freaking snipers on the bridge. Right? But what? Wait, down here,
grease on the wall.
Right? There's walls are greased. Are those thumbtacks? Who glued thumbtacks to a bridge? Right.
And sooner or later, they might dump hot oil down the
thing. Right.
What you'll notice is there are cracks. As soon as you climb through, as soon as you make yourself skinny enough to slither through that crack, I guarantee you a robot will come out and smooth it over with some caulk, repaint it, and make it look like we just put new bricks in here, right? And then the next person behind you, the next 10,000 people behind you, each individually has to find their new crack. Yeah. Nobody can go, hey, see this crack I just climbed through? Hurry up. There's none of that. You get
none
shot doing that.
None of that.
Don't do that. Don't help people like that.
I mean, there's no way I could have done this fresh out of college. Mm-hmm. Like, I wasn't prepared.
Right.
You know, mentally prepared. It's the 18 moves and all the other stuff that have prepared me to be patient, to know to move on to the other thing until this thing possibly pops off. So I have to just remember, leave the corporate benchmarks with Satan's Workshop.
That's right.
That is gone. They are a thing of the past and currently becoming a script. So we'll just move on from that and I'll just keep keep at it.
There can't be a deadline. Because if you give yourself a deadline, then you have all the... Then you're killing yourself for things you didn't do.
Right.
I had
the other career that I put down. It was 3 years after I put down the career to my first sale, which wasn't a sale in the industry. Mm-hmm. It was a sale to a Star Trek.
Right.
Books. Right. I started, by any conceivable notion, a minimum of 5 years, quote unquote, too late for when you're supposed to start your writing career out here. And it took me about 5 years... to land right. my thing. And they say you're supposed to allocate 10. Well, at I'm least. Like, whoever they are, shut up.
Nobody asked them.
Nobody asked them. And it doesn't yeah. work like be, that. Right. But yeah. if your 10-year is your window, like if I don't get somewhere where I want to be within right. 10, it might be time to take another, you don't want to waste your life,
right.
basically.
Right.
But anything under 10, mm-hmm. you're a G. That's the way I look at it, yeah. right? So if it took you 8.5 years to get, quote unquote, where you wanted to go, mm-hmm. you're a G. You broke the 10-year rule, you know? But yeah, this idea that you're failing every day, that you're not achieving here, that's foolish.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, though, Jeff. I mean, it's hard to do. Just like you, Jeff, we moved here to be an actor when we first moved here, right?
True.
You come here and you have illusions of grandeur. You're like, shit, I was in San Francisco getting at least 2 auditions a month. Mm-hmm. So in LA, I'm going to get 3 or 4 a week.
Right. I'm about to kill these fools.
And you have 1 every 4 months. You feel me? Depending on who you are, what's going on with your category.
And how you land, right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the illusions of grandeur can fuck you up. Mm-hmm. So you have to learn to be, what's the word I want to use? Prolific is the one thing that comes to mind. And like you out meeting people, going to lunch, doing all that stuff are things that people don't think they want to do because they're like, well, why would I need to do that? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I should just be able to go and audition and get a role.
Yeah.
But you are setting yourself. For example, I'm just going to use that as this little sideway.
Go.
The show that I'm on now came because of relationships.
Yeah.
You know, everything landed in the way that it was supposed to land for me. It wasn't supposed to land for somebody else. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to land for me. The showrunner is my friend. The creator is my friend. You know what I mean? I write in that genre. Whatever it is for you is for you. Mm-hmm. And so your job is to be ready for it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know what I mean? And that's what I'm learning more and more and more. No matter what projects I do on the side, no matter what I'm doing, I'm always trying to just be ready mm-hmm. for whatever is to come. So you have to learn to say yes to things you wouldn't
I
say yes to.
I think that corporate life kind of taught me about that, though. Like, you cultivate relationships. And I came from, what I was doing was, I worked for an aerospace engineering company in D.C.
That's fascinating.
And I was doing project management for a big contract. So there was a lot of whining and dining with people at the FAA and all these government agencies. So I got to see a lot of that. You have to cultivate the relationship.
So you guys can't see this, but the way she's describing these amazing things is like, oh, and then I went to lunch with so-and-so. Like, if you could see the body language, you'd be like ready to hang yourself right now.
Well, there's something interesting that Jeff said about unless you grow up in the arts, how it is. See, I think about, you know, some of these people who make it big, you know, someone like Lena Dunham or like J.J. Abrams or I think what's interesting is that it's not necessarily the, but okay, so let's take Lena Dunham, for example. Mm-hmm. I think her mom is an artist. Now, I know Jeff is upset about this, but this is the point, like, about a lot of things that are about it. The behavior, like, there's so many unwritten things that it takes you a long time to learn out here.
Yes, that's true.
They are aware of that from their parents early on.
Just what are they swimming?
And that gives them that kind of advantage that other people, especially from the corporate world, I think sometimes the behavior codes of the corporate world are so the antithesis of what the creative has to do. It takes you like a minute to dial that down and go the opposite way, and that's, I think, tough for people because everything in society is teaching you how to be that corporate cog.
There's a kind of from one end of the spectrum to the other. Like I have a degree in screenwriting. Like I have a film degree, but couldn't quite get there right after college. So then I went corporate. So now I'm going back, and so it's
But here's
you're straddling
the thing.
Two worlds.
I'll tell this story. I was in the writer's room on Leverage, and everybody else in the room was either a seasoned pro. Or they've been to Harvard, or they studied physics or high-end mathematics and all that.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And one of the fun things one of my bosses liked to do with one of the other writers was they would throw formula at each other.
Oh my
like
God.
Blah, 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 right? And then at the end of the formula discussion, which was literally just symbols and numbers, okay, and properties, they would both laugh like a joke had been told. And I was like, this is messed up, man. What the hell is this?
You know,
I'm supposed
to
be the smart guy around here.
Keep your thought. Right. Let me just interrupt you really quickly because I just put this on Facebook. There was a guy on Google, a black guy from Compton. I posted it. He He was like some tech dude who got into Google, that thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And he talked about imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. And I can relate to that because sometimes I'm sitting there in a room and I'm listening to these really smart Harvard, Princeton writers talk about shit.
I'm about to fix it.
Go ahead.
All right. So, by the way, I don't have that. I'm not humble. Okay, I'm a goddamn gladiator. You better bring all your tools if you want to fight me as a writer. Okay, I'm not playing. That's I can drop you and will easily. Good friends, enemies, doesn't matter. I'm a gladiator. Okay, but in this particular room, I became on this one day. I wouldn't say sheepish, but I suddenly realized, like you just said, I don't have my degree is in acting. Yeah. I got a degree in theater with like a minor in theater history, right. I guess, yeah. right? What can you apply that to? No actor ever got a job by showing their diploma. Let me put it like that. Okay. And no writer did ever either. So I had these various, very smart, very capable, all good writers. And my boss looked over at me. He's like, "What's up, Jeff?" Because they never see a look of sheepishness on my face, right? And I was like, "Well, you know, Harvard over here, such and such over here. You motherfuckers right here are just doing this crazy, like Einstein versus, you know, whoever danced. Fuck all of you." And he's like, "So you're feeling what, intimidated?" And I was like, "I don't know if I ever feel that, but if there is a country called intimidation, I can see it from the coast." Right. He's like, "Jeff, all these people have all this stuff, and you're just here." And I'm like, "What?" He's like, "They have all this background, and you're sitting here with them as an equal or a superior. What did you need?"
Oh my God, that's my revelation too.
Right.
I sat in that.
You are here to play.
Yes.
You can play. It doesn't matter how you got trained. It doesn't matter. Like, I mean, you could be Draco Malfoy, or you could be Harry, but it doesn't matter because all of us are up in here together right now, and it's just who can do it and who can't.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people, like these Harvard types, because you meet a disproportionate number of them in this industry, is that they kind of like use that as a weapon in a weird way because I think that they're they have to use it as a shield. They have to use it as a shield, as armor, because I don't know if they can really get out there and present some other type of experience.
Yeah, there's that. But I don't want to say this. By the way, Leverage remains the greatest job I've ever been on, and all the people I work with were fantastic.
Sure.
I wouldn't say even. The two Harvard guys are like really good guys, and they're good friends of mine, and help me out, and I try to help them out whenever. It isn't like that. It was all a personal response to like, wait, I literally devoted my entire life to the arts, and I'm in a room full of people who didn't do that. And some of the things that they didn't do are kind of incredible. Like, I'm a physicist as well as this. I'm this as well as this. You know, I'm a writer. It sounds like it's the least of the things in the room. But in fact, like I said, I'm a goddamn gladiator, and these other gladiators might have trained at the hyper school on the planet, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And I trained with my brass weapons in the desert of my little town. Exactly. But I will gut your ass.
Right?
And that's what my boss told me. You are a gladiator.
And that's when I realized, too, Jeff, I was sitting in the room, and they were talking about politics and all the stuff, things that I just don't give a fuck. It's just my opinion. And I was just listening, and for some reason, I went into that imposter syndrome. Like, how the fuck
You're not an imposter.
Just hear me out. I was there for like 20 minutes just listening to them. You know, you just chopping the shit in the beginning right before you get anything. And I just was sitting there quietly just like listening to all these super smart people talking. For a minute, I'm going, man, I didn't graduate from high school. I got my GED. I started like going there.
Right. But that's the opposite direction.
And I went, and I looked at the comic book that we're doing for the show, and I went, wait a minute, but nobody in this room actually was in the scene. I was. You know what I mean?
That's
so whenever we're talking, they're asking me.
Mm-hmm. You saw what's that movie where Leonardo DiCaprio is a gunslinger?
Oh,
you know what it is. Sharon Stone's in it.
Quick and the Dead.
Quick and the Dead. Yeah. That's your life.
Right.
You are that. Everyone came to that town. Some of them were dressed crazy. Some of them were rich. Some of them came off the farm and they only had their dad's gun and one bullet. Doesn't matter. You're a killer. Right. Kill.
Yeah, that's my point. I think that it's kind of weird in this country because it's like the country doesn't really celebrate artists in a way.
Right.
And I think that like writers are such important for everyone's inner life that if you go to Harvard, it's like you said, that's not getting you a job, that degree. Right. So it's kind of like it doesn't matter where you you know, like learns your swordsmanship.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know how to fucking swing that blade. Look! I tell you what it's like. You know what it's like? It's like in Lone Wolf and Cub.
Yeah.
They all have their sword schools. Mm-hmm. And you know what? There's some sword schools that aren't part of the shogunate, but they still whip everyone's ass. They
whip your ass.
And that's all that matters in the battle.
And that's the thing I think a lot of people have a hard time with in terms of setting milestones and all that kind of stuff. I would imagine in the corporate world that it's slightly more merit-based, but there's still a component of who you know, who's your friend, who's your enemy. Mm-hmm. There's a certain amount of backstabbery that goes on, all that stuff. Our industries, the art industries, are relatively soft by comparison. There's not as many straight lines to rise, right? Mm-hmm. But the other side of that is the randomness serves you as much as it hurts you. The softness serves you as much as it hurts you. So you'll come out of a meeting where those people were always sweet to you, and you didn't get the job after all.
Right.
Right. Yeah. They were great. Yeah. Everyone loved me. Pat me on the head. You're so wonderful. And then you don't get the job. You can get a little mad and depressed. Is this going to keep happening? But on the other side of that, you can come out of a meeting where everybody was kind of frosty.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, I don't even know if I like these people. You know? And then they call you. And all of a sudden, they're like, you know, we're about to pay you tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars to do something you were doing anyway.
Right.
And come play with us.
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing about the meetings when people are frosty like that. I've found that when they're frosty, it's because they're trying to process what you told them that they like and that they can't multitask their ability to be super civil with you and like, oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit. Because I remember one time we had pissed something over at Fox, the TV people, and they were kind of lukewarm in the room, and we were leaving the room. And walk into, and they were saying goodbye and everything like that. And they stopped us in the hall and said, no, you know what? We actually want to do the show.
Right.
And we were like, we thought we fucked that up.
We were like, you know, go drink some beers and call our girls up.
Yeah, because their behavior was so much like, get the fuck out of here kind of thing. And it was like, and I was like, oh. And that happened another time, one time. And then we almost got something and then it didn't go because someone else. And then I began to realize it's like, you know, like when they're so like, they don't want to show how excited they are.
Right.
That's them.
Everybody's playing,
you know, their cards. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, fuck. Now, you know what? That's the fucking, like, ace in the hole. Like, you know, he put the Trump down. Mm-hmm. How do we fucking deal with that? And they kind of freeze up. And when they freeze up, they like, please leave so we can discuss.
You
just can't
know. You might actually literally stumble on a sentence that they had just said to each other in private about the project. You know, it's just like if silver turned into gold, right? Some random ass stuff that you would have never said on your own, right? And in their mind, a light bulb goes off and they're like, this guy gets it,
right?
I don't get anything. I have no idea what you people are talking about. But I said the right trigger, and now I'm in. And I don't know. And like you said, if they're good at their job, their poker face is impenetrable. Right.
Yeah.
Right? You can't tell. So the softness, everything we're trained as kids up until young adulthood is, if I do X, barring racism, barring sexism, barring weird outside things that prevent my rise, I should do okay, right? Even if I was a B-plus student, there's a place for the B-plus student in a corporate structure. Mm-hmm. There's a place for the AAA student in a corporate structure. There's a place for a C student in a corporate structure.
Yeah.
If I do X and there's not an extra factor that's against me, I should be fine.
Yeah.
Out here, it's...
I found that I could Google... I had no prior experience in doing project management before I got that job. They saw something in me and was like, oh, hey, you seem nice. Come on up. And so I literally spent the first 3 months Googling how to be a project manager,
right?
Yeah, how to do my job. And then I realized, oh, they don't know what they're doing either.
Mm-hmm.
This is great. This is fine. And I stuck with that for 5 years. Mm-hmm. Like I wound up, I remember thinking they made a mistake. They must have mistook me for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not supposed to be here.
Why I don't do this, by the way. I suffer from this.
I'm surrounded by people with master's degrees in engineering, and for just 3 months, they must have really screwed this up. Okay, let me Google this before they find out that I have no idea what the hell I'm talking about.
But on
about.
The other side of that, clearly, both of you are people who are achievers. All three of you are people who are like, I want to go over there, and I'm going over there. And you do go over there, whatever over there is to you. Yeah. And then you get there.
Yeah. I go over there and knock somebody's drink over.
Right? You will. I know that.
I'll take a sip.
When you land there, and it wasn't something you just built yourself, where it's you're clustered around these other folks who are kind of like you in a weird way. You don't realize it. What is it that triggers, what makes it kick in, this idea that I might not belong here? Because my whole thing was just, I can't keep up with this ridiculous conversation about formulas and mathematics and all that kind of stuff.
I couldn't keep up with the conversation about reduced vertical separation mediums and blah, okay, blah, blah.
I'm done.
And
I was just Yeah, I quit. No, you should have fired me. I quit.
7 years later, it's like, oh, holy shit, that was actually really cool stuff. But
right.
At the time, I was just like, right.
Okay.
But see,
I know what that is.
Yeah,
the
sure.
The thing about you, Hilliard, is that if you start talking about the scene, they wouldn't be able to keep up.
And that's what happened.
Yeah.
That's every day at some point, like somebody asked me about it.
Like,
you know,
like
what I mean?
That's the thing that I think people need to be aware of. I mean, we talk about this a lot in the show. It's like,
that's my superpower.
It's your superpower.
Don't look at what you think you're lacking, but you know, focus on the things that you actually do have.
Everyone has their kryptonite.
Yeah.
Right. You know, shit. But, you know, but Superman, when you talk about Superman, you never focus on the kryptonite. You focus on the plethora of powers.
Yeah.
I always try to, once I feel like, I wouldn't say it's conscious, but I try to tell this to young writers and new writers coming out. Never tell your sob story unless it ends with gold, right? You can talk about the tragedy of your life, but it better end on a really up note, in an exact inverse to how bad it began. So I start in this horrible African village during apartheid, blah, 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 blah. But now I'm Elon Musk, right? It has to end that way, or don't tell that story
because
it's too dark. People don't want to, they lie and say they want to know you.
Yeah.
They don't want to know that shit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Give me a Hollywood ending.
But once you, right, Hollywood wants a Hollywood ending.
Yes.
But on the other side of that, you don't need to lie either. Just the biggest trick is figuring out what it is that they see that they like. Mm-hmm. So that if they want to hire you, you've presented your best self in theory. They liked your best self, but you don't know what aspects of your best self they like.
Right. Right.
So don't worry about pleasing them in that sense, but understand that they already made the decision to like you.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like talking to girls at a club. If you walk up to a girl at a club, guys, here's some actual game instead of that incel bullshit, okay? By the time...
You can't just wipe?
Children, please. Meet people. Meet actual people.
Go outside.
And it's, I'm let's say, whatever the Kinsey scale is, let's say I'm 97.5% straight, okay? So I'm going to refer to this as cisgender terms, but it works for everybody. When you walk up to the object of your affection in a dance club, she has watched you walk up.
Right.
Yep.
All of that was tracking your ass and making her assessment.
Right.
So if you get to the point where you can even ask for that dance, you're at 100% right there.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you say after that is points being taken off. Literally everything.
That's
everything
funny.
You do or say after that is 97, 98,
91, 50,
you get down to 62,
you
should go back to your boys and try another lady.
You know what? I'm done with this song.
But the same thing is true in this industry. It's basically always that moment.
Mm-hmm.
If they like you, they already like you. So your job is to minimize the things that make them take off.
Minimize the deductions.
Okay.
Okay, but this is the point you made. You add about like, you know, like you don't know what people like about you. I think part of something that you have to do is you got to ask friends of yours who are really close friends, what do you see about me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is the positive thing? So you know how to like amplify
and don't
that.
Get defensive.
And and what's the negative
that's hard
stuff?
To do.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it takes courage to ask that question, and then your friends have to be that close friends to be honest with you.
Right. Yeah.
Because if they lie to you, I mean, they might lie because they don't want to hurt your feelings. But you honestly like, look, I gotta know this because I gotta make some adjustments to make these meetings better.
So it becomes a balance of like pitching yourself before you can even pitch any sort of project
because
they're both very
who's
important.
Your superhero self? Who's your when you pull open the chest, whose emblem is sitting there?
Right.
The emblem that's sitting there is you in Hollywood.
Yeah.
All that other stuff is for back at the headquarters with the people who's like, look, I know everybody calls you Superman, but I know your ass is Clark. So let's talk about what's going on with you and Lois. That's all for home.
Yeah.
Okay. People will pretend and lie that they want that aspect of you because they want to feel like good people in the world or something, but it's entirely horseshit.
Yeah.
Entirely. Even the nicest, best, most sincere, complete fucking horseshit.
Right.
Right? And from your point of view, you only can, that's the hard part of the job because you really have to segregate out the negative aspects. Now, the other part of the job that's really hard is, let's say you had a bad meeting and it's universally, both sides of the desk are like, God damn, that was horrible. You know, and you're going home and you're like, I'm never going to work and all this other shit. And your agents call you up and they're like, wow, why? What did you do? Did you bring in a nuke and blow everything up? What the fuck? They called us screaming. What the hell? And you think logically, what you all should do is put your heads together and go, okay, what did I do to fuck up that meeting?
Right.
So I can apply it to the next meeting. Mm-hmm. Except the next meeting is going to be with completely different people. They're going to want different things. They're going to see different things. And so you're going to be the logical bounce from the first bad meeting is, oh, okay, well, they didn't like that I was a little bit too big, or they didn't like how I cut my hair, or I had a political statement on my T-shirt. I should never wear that T-shirt again. Oh, my God, I can burn that T-shirt. Right. That's all bullshit. It's all because of the logic of normal business that makes you go, oh, okay, well, when I go to my next law firm, probably I shouldn't wear the dashiki. I should probably wear a tie, right? Unless it's the dashiki law firm, wherein that's okay, right? But
culture,
right? So when you pop out of that, you want to exert control. Mm-hmm. The hardest thing all of us have to learn in the arts is that the only control you have is in the product you produce. You have to make a lot of scripts. In theory, they should be of a wide variety, or conversely, if you are the action-adventure guy or the science fiction gal, then you need to make a lot of scripts. Mm-hmm. You need a lot of bullets for your gun belt, okay? Because that's what you do. That's the control you exert. When someone reads your script and it's undeniable, all the other little cosmetic stuff starts to fall away. You have to be truly psychotic in this town, as we all know, that to have a really awesome script, and they're like, yeah, but she's psychotic. Did you read this script?
Right.
That's Hollywood.
Right.
Yeah, but you know, but you're right, because even those psychopaths get work.
Do they? Really? In this town? No. What?
And run shit. And,
how dare you? What are you? You better tell the children the truth.
And not just get work, but they run shit.
Yeah, I don't know what he's talking about. He's just making up stories now.
That's the wild part. So let's get into some questions.
Okay.
Okay.
So I'm going to start with this one. So our good friend, our other big bro, Paul Gio,
my man,
put out something to you this morning, which
I
loved. Right? I'm going to read it to you. I'm going to read your basic answer, and then we'll
expand on Twitter?
On it. Yeah. He sent it on Twitter. So he said, so Jeff Thorne, what's the biggest difference between writing animation for TV and live action for TV? And here was your short answer. You can expand on this.
Okay.
You said, wow, the absolute lack of subtext, plot, 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 all emotions right on the surface. So let's get into that.
Animation, as it has... Okay, there's a...
And by the way, let me interrupt you. We got a plane going by with a... What do they call it? A little banner?
Oh, what
tells
does that
you,
say?
I don't know. I can't see it from
it's
here.
It's too small, guys.
It just keeps rolling around. We're in
no
Hollywood.
No one knows what you're saying.
So forgive us if you
stop.
Guys hear
it. Why are you whispering?
Yeah. No, it's probably going to be doing it the whole show.
You are literally holding a megaphone. Why are you whispering? Okay. The difference between writing for animation and writing for live action. There are certain tools you're not allowed to use. Sex, hyperviolence, politics, religion. All that kind of stuff is basically out. All the things that adults would do to relate to one another. But really fundamentally in live action, you're going to be relating to actors who are seen. Mm-hmm. So those actors are going to add nuance to your work that is not even necessarily in the work. They're just going to bring themselves to it. Right. In cartoons, Wonder Woman looks exactly like Wonder Woman every week, every moment of the frame. She's not going to do anything you don't tell her to do.
True.
She's going to be exactly how you want her to do. And the voice actors, when they do add nuance, sometimes the nuance is better than what the image is. Like the actors are sometimes, I would even say often, better than what the animators do for various reasons that have nothing to do with the animation. The animation can be brilliant too, right? It's just the way the cogs work. But from the writing point of view, the tool that you lose really most aggressively is there's no such thing as subtlety. Everybody says what they actually think, or they say nothing. Right? Those are your tools. So like even if you look at a really sophisticated show like Legend of Korra, where it has a lot of subtle, I guess, subtleties of emotion going on, if you go back and really look at it, very few people do anything that isn't a straight-up lie, which the audience knows it's a lie, or they say what they feel, or they say, why I'm not telling you why what I really feel.
Let me ask you a question about that. I mean, do you think that's really just a function of the fact that you're looking at drawings and not people's faces?
No, because... I think it's a matter of how expensive it is to make animation. We went round and round about, oh my God, I can't tell you this story yet. I'm literally disallowed from telling you the inner workings of working on a Black Panther. So let me try to make this abstract. When you're making an animated series, you're spending a lot less money. Technically, animation can provide nuance, as you've seen in every Disney movie, every Pixar movie. Like, but they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars. There's literally a crew that just does the facial expressions, right? Don't have time or money for that in TV animation. So if you go in back and look at even your most favorite, let's say the Batman Adventures or the Justice League or Young Justice or one of that, really go back and look at the faces. They're largely static, right? The emotional expressions don't change unless it's just active anger, like straight up, like the stereotypical. When I say I'm angry, you get this crazy picture in your head. That's
Skeletor and
stuff like that, because there's really no time for subtleties of facial expression. So the level of difficulty in some ways increases. I always say writing for children, although not all animation is for children, some of it's for everybody. We're trying to do all ages with Black Panther, by the way. Writing for children is harder than writing for anyone else. Children are vicious and mean. Mm-hmm. They do not care. They don't care about your process. They don't care about whatever. They're like, I don't like that. Move on to the next.
Right.
And you have fewer tools to write for them. You cannot use subtlety because they have not grasped that concept yet. So all these things conspire in what Americans mostly think of animation as for kids. So I don't personally. I just think a story is a story. But because of that overhanging sort of stricture, you have to, and I had to learn this, by the way. It's not like I'm some freaking genius and I walked over from live action and I was like, oh, okay, this will be easy. Mm-mm. There are things I would try to do, and my very competent showrunners would say, yeah, that's great. And if we were shooting this live action, that scene would stay in. Mm-hmm. No, can't do it. Yeah. Do something else to express that.
Right.
So I would say it seems simpler, but the simplicity is like trying to write a haiku. You think it's easy, go try and write one.
Well, you know, I just started bringing it up because the other night I was watching this video on Anthony Hopkins' work in Westworld.
Okay.
And this guy breaks down this scene in the first season when he's talking with the corporate woman at this restaurant. And it's interesting because he was like, okay, so here's the scene where the woman asks Anthony Hopkins a question. And it's like, watch this moment, this guy says. And she asks him a question. And he pauses for 7 seconds before answering. But in those 7 seconds, the guy breaks down like the range of emotions he goes through without saying anything, moving his head, changing his eyes, like half smile, a frown, all in the 7 seconds, and then he responds. And I was like, fuck, that's some brilliant fucking acting. That's what I'm saying. It's like, and that's, you meant the subtleties that you can't get in the facial expressions.
And it's not even a matter of you can't. It's going from writing a novel. Every novelist is not a good screenwriter. Every screenwriter is not a good novelist. Right. Every novelist can't write a short story. Every short story writer can't write a novel.
Yeah.
Comic book writers think, oh, I'll just jump over to screenwriting. I'm like, no, you won't. And screenwriters even more so.
Right.
It's actually easier to transition up from comics to screenwriting than it is to transition down.
Yeah.
Because screenwriters don't realize how much they rely on motion.
Right.
You realize how much you rely on motion when you try to write a comic book where there isn't
any.
Interesting.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, because you just, in a comic, you're trying to find like those panels that mean that are conveying emotion most, and you know, and you can kind of like stretch, and you can stretch out a moment in a comic in a way you can.
What you just said,
you know,
every time on my Twitter feed, I watch a writer who's never been writing comics and they got their first gig and whatever. Almost invariably, there'll be a day where they realize that what we call the gutters, which are the white space in a comic, in a traditional comic, because they don't all have gutters, but generally, if there's gutters, that's time.
Yeah.
Right. And you can do shit with the time of the gutters. Mm-hmm. And as soon as a comic book writer who wasn't one before realizes that, it's like, oh, damn, right? And then their work changes completely after that, right? But it's one of those osmosis things. You kind of have to be doing it to learn it. Mm-hmm. And same thing with writing animation. It's simpler, but I write adventure. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what it's like to write. I feel like comedy and romance, comedy first because you're trying to guarantee a laugh. Doesn't matter, live action, PG, G-rated, whatever. You're basically saying, I'm going to write all this stuff over here, and in months later, years later, all these people are going to laugh. God bless you. You're the bravest souls in the world. And love. It's nearly impossible to write love because everyone's like, that's not how it feels.
Right.
It's close, but no. It's how it looks, but that's not how it feels. Anyway, and so, yeah, it lacks nuance.
Lauren, you do action, right? That's your thing?
Yes. What's action. Action with pops of comedy.
Right. Now, see, I we've talked about this. I think it's really, really important. There are a lot of women out there, women writers, who do this. And I think we need more of it.
In animation.
I grew up
in animation.
That. Like, that's all I know.
One of the things that I noticed when I went into animation was I did it as a hobby for many years, and then it added up as, wow, you're actually, this is like a second career.
No, you're a showrunner.
Your hobby is everything. Yeah. Your hobby is everything you do when you're not doing this other thing.
Exactly.
But what I noticed was there's several things that conspire against women and minorities in animation in specific. Mm-hmm. One, the money's not that great by comparison to live action.
Right.
Two, no residuals for most part.
Guild.
right. The shows that you watch, like The Simpsons and all that, those are treated like sitcoms. They're treated like live action sitcoms. They're covered by the Writers Guild mm-hmm. and the Screen Actors Guild and all of that stuff. So the monies that people make, those actors on The Simpsons could get rich being on The Simpsons all the time.
Could.
The actors who work the actors who work in what you think of as Saturday morning cartoons, all the rest of the cartoons, basically, that aren't at night.
Mm-hmm.
They don't get any of that. They don't get residuals. The writers don't get anything. They get much smaller pay, all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a budding screenwriter, and even though you always wanted to write that really great Korra episode, once you get out here, it's kind of like not good for your wallet to want to get into it. Two, up until extremely recently, women were segregated away from action adventure, possibly consciously, but really just for the basic dude prejudice of that joke I made about gamer girls, right? I've had my ass kicked a lot online by young ladies that were like, ha ha, I got your ass, right? And I'm like, I didn't feel any particular shame based on being beat by a woman. I got shame by being beat.
Yeah,
right?
That's the thing. I don't care who beats me, it's just I've been
like, fuck, how did she even do that, right? She's not supposed to run up the walls in this game. It's a Western game. How do you even run up the walls doing that? Whatever. Okay, but in animation, it's a good microcosm of all writing. For many, many years, women were segregated, directed towards background painting.
Mm-hmm.
So in the actual animation area, you could be a great animator, but where's the job for you?
Mm-hmm.
The job for you is in background painting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you want to eat, you better be a background painter too. You meant to be greatest, right? And for writing, writing grew up in animation in a really weird way as sort of the last thing to happen, where everything else was based on visual gags and technical stuff. So, again, it's conspiring against women and minorities to want to enter it because the dividend at the end is not big enough to sustain.
Right.
You have to be so good at it and juggling multiple shows in order to have a life at it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look around and you're trying to staff your show and you're like, well, you know, here's a handful of women I know. They're going to know a bunch of other women.
Mm-hmm.
I have to justify to the studio why this person who's been writing My Little Pony her whole life can now come over and write this thing about ninjas who shoot people in the neck.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm a writer, so I'm like, look, I read her work.
Yeah.
She can do this.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we trusting you exactly? We're barely trusting your ass. So, you know, that woman doesn't get to rise.
Mm-hmm.
So the women that I wanted to work, some of the women I wanted, I shouldn't say women because I got the women I wanted, but there are other women. It could have been a lot more women friendly, except the women I wanted also, they've been in the animation industry a lot. They're always busy because there's five of them,
right?
There shouldn't be. There should be 500 of them, but you have to have a reason to want to get in. I think it's edging away now. I think the generation of like 20-somethings and maybe to 30, there's women that are like, screw that. I came here to take names and kick asses and maybe have ice cream. But if we're out of ice cream, those asses are getting kicked. And they're kind of like, no, I always wanted to write animation. I grew up on anime.
Yeah.
I got schooled on Sailor Moon literally yesterday morning because it's kind of like, I've heard so many women writers, certainly of animation, be like, Sailor Moon was my jam.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, Sailor Moon? Right? It's like, shut up, Jap. But then they break it down for you. And I'm like, well, that's just an action show. It just has these three extra elements in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it focuses on women.
Mm-hmm.
My jam would have been Kim Possible.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But I was, anyway, that's a whole other show. But the point
don't
is
get
that
them started.
Until recently, there weren't enough women going, no, I just want to do this.
Yeah.
Right? This. I don't want to be over there. I want to be over here doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, I think I think it has to do with what you were saying earlier, Lauren, about the video game, the rise of the video games. I kind of think that there's, because like when I was growing up, there was not a lot of women who would play video games.
Yeah.
But around the time when the NES came out and Sega Genesis and stuff like that, it became more of a, it just became more open.
Yeah.
Because to me, I mean, because when I was first playing video games, I go to the arcade, right? You've never seen women in the arcade. You never see girls.
Well, it's hostile to women in the arcade.
It totally is. It totally is.
What girls walking into a room full of sweaty testosterone? Well, see. But you're rare. But you're rare. You're going to go to an arcade filled with teenage boys.
I would have a sandwich bag full of quarters and my parents would just leave me. Go.
God bless you.
See, so I think that the console allowed women to play the games that they wanted to play and not to walk into this hostile environment.
And it's a meritocracy.
Yeah.
It's a meritocracy. That squad of females in Ghost Recon, they can kick your ass, dude.
Yeah.
It's not because they're chicks. They're just beating your ass.
I grew up with those games. I grew up with those films. And I think you and I talked the last time I was here. Like the very first script I ever tried to write, I think I told you this, was my own version of Terminator 3 because I had seen Terminator 2. I was 12 when it came out.
Okay.
And my mind was blown. And I was like, I want to do that. I want to make something like that. I want to create a person like Sarah Connor. And so I, before we had a computer, I hand wrote about 100 and something pages and was trying to find out how to contact James Cameron and was like, I want to do this. And,
I love that naiveness when you're innocent.
I mean, I was
That's
12.
Very naive.
But it's, I was
you're
12.
Right, it's some innocence.
Well, it was great. You don't know. She can remember coaching,
I remember going to the theater with my mom to watch Aliens when it first came out. And when we got out, I wanted to play Ripley with all my friends. I wanted to play in the, I wanted to have the power loader and all this stuff. And so I look back on all that, and that shapes 98% of what I write.
Representation fucking matters.
It does. Mm-hmm. It really does. But now we talked about me writing that story about my time in Kosovo, which is not an action story.
Oh, you
and
know
it
this?
Is right. It's painful.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I am struggling.
She's just dropping shit, man. Mm-hmm.
She lived in Kosovo for like
2 years.
Shit, like, oh, and then I was in Kosovo.
After college, when I couldn't get a job, when I couldn't come out here.
You, of course, went to Kosovo.
because my family lived in Germany. My dad was stationed in Germany at the time.
Military.
Yeah. So he was stationed in Germany. So he was like, well, you ain't got to go. But you should probably find a job somewhere. Yeah.
You can't stay here, though.
But you can't stay here. So, series of random events. My mom overheard somebody talking about the need to fill a position. She called me, and I was on a plane 2 weeks later.
Wow.
And I stayed for what was supposed to be 4 months turned into 2 years.
Well,
I stayed
gotta get until this girl out of the house.
That's saying yes, though. That's saying yes.
Where can we send her? Well, Kosovo's free.
I keep saying, did you watch the movie The Whistleblower? Have you seen the movie The Whistleblower?
No, I put it in my queue because you told me about it last time I was here. Yes.
Yeah,
I have been just struggling. So I actually went back to Toronto a couple weeks ago, and I was looking at old pictures of my time there.
Okay.
And it really sort of opened up and sparked some things. So that's actually helped. Brought back some of the photos, and I was like, okay, I can do this. I can do this. Part of the reason why I realize I'm struggling is because my time there ended when my mom passed away. So there's a bit of a...
Right.
I don't want to touch it. I don't want to touch that yet.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
But you know what?
That's why you have to touch it.
That's the goal. Yeah.
That's the goal.
Right.
So I'm 2 acts into the pilot, and I'm just like, okay, I'm going to get through this. Then I thought, maybe I should just write that episode.
Why not?
I'm going to get through this episode?
That particular episode, right? And just get it out of the way. Then it's like that whole part about the bulletproof vest and helmet. Mm-hmm. I can't stop laughing when I think about that because, I tried to run. Like, they were like, do you have this? Why the fuck do I need that? You told me I was safe.
There's no safe.
I left it in the car.
It's a war zone.
I'll be right back.
It's Kosovo. Are you stupid?
It was a little after everything had popped off.
Mom, do you hate me? Why would you give me a job here?
When I tell you.
It's a war zone.
I honestly, Jeff, had no idea where I was going.
All right, let me throw something
there.
Cool about this, even above the fact of it, because holy shit, is a lot of us who write are dissimilar to what the popular culture tells you about whatever group we're in, gay, black, female, Latin, whatever, and you'll come into an office with these stories. The reason of representation, that inclusion matters, is that my wife is like that. Mm-hmm. She's Marion Ravenwood. She goes to war zones and helps rebuild after earthquakes and all this kind of, she's an NGO worker, right? So was my dad. So I had a very strange upbringing by normal person standards. It's not better or worse, just weird, right? You need that voice. You need to see more women. You need to see more women of color telling stories of, and then I went to Kosovo. Right,
we got Under the Tuscan Sun. We've got Eat, Pray, Love, but we don't have.
So when you say there's a dearth of this kind of material, where are the women out there that are writing? What I was getting at before, and I didn't quite get to, is there is a component of there not enough candidates in certain weird areas. Right. And the way that you get more candidates is to make those areas attractive to those candidates. You can't just go, oh, we looked for some chicks, didn't find enough chicks. We have binders of women. Right? You're like, dude, please, I got a Rolodex. Just call me. You need some women to write your show. I tell you what, see, just call me.
Yeah, see, it's interesting you brought up like aliens. It's like, it's kind of weird in me in a certain sense because like I have seen so many movies, and maybe it's because of like the type of projects I look at to see. It's like I see a lot of projects and I'm interested in seeing projects that are either written by women, star women, or, you know, or directed by women, you know, mm-hmm. because I kind of, you know, it's like we were talking the other day, I think like, you know, like Lisa and I mm-hmm. were talking about like Catherine Bigelow, and it's like, oh, you know, you know, people kind of forget that, you know, that like she did Near Dark and like
the greatest vampire movie.
You know, she did that. She did Point Break, yeah. and she did that Strange Days, and it's kind of like, you know, what she jumped into doing those kind of like those kind of like masculine type of films, mm-hmm. but she added something, and it's like with Alien too. Like to me, like growing up. You know, and it's like you mentioned, you know, like Marion Ravenwood. It's like to me, it's like that's what I see as like those projects always meant something more to me, mm-hmm. and those projects because always played better. Rare, right? You know, but then you step back and you go, those things were such anomalies. But I think that the reason why they were so successful is because of that anomaly that right. they did like shift things around in a certain way. I mean, you mentioned Sarah Connor. I mean, I kind of think like. You think about the Terminator, and it's always about Sarah Connor. Always. And mm-hmm.
But
the
here's
guy.
The genius. Like, here's the genius of that
franchise.
Forget
about Reese.
Yeah, she's the A story.
Yeah. Think yeah. If you go watch the original Terminator, she's the damsel mm-hmm. until yeah. about 2/3 of the way through.
Yeah, yeah.
She makes a switch there's yeah. a certain point. Yeah. Like, you know what? Bite me with this shit.
Right. But that's why it's a great story, though.
Right. Yeah. Up until that point, it's Reese going, "Run, you stupid woman! Do you not see the robot trying to kill everybody?"
Right.
Yeah, but it's really weird. Bitch, run! Right? And then she's like, you know what? Fuck that running shit. Let's yeah. kill this motherfucker. Right. And then Terminator 2, she's just that person.
Yeah, she yes. got
she
all
didn't have to have it explained.
And yes.
Right?
And I didn't see the first one before. I saw them out of order. I saw the second one
first. Oh, you saw Terminator
first. I mean, I was 5 when the first one came out. Right. So there was a line my parents drew, I guess,
now,
taking me to that one.
At that time,
one.
As you
but,
know...
I didn't know that she was a damsel. And I was a little confused as to why, okay, why is she running? But yeah, I loved that she wasn't anymore. And
she
that
switched.
Was like
she had character arc. God
she's
forbid.
A 12-year-old girl.
But
that's
the thing, you know, as a film historian, remember,
yes,
those movies were everyone accredits them to James Cameron alone.
Right.
Gail Ann Hurd and James
yes.
Cameron
yep.
made
Gail
those movies.
Yep.
And Gunnar Gale ain't nobody to fool with. Mm-hmm. Okay, yep. So what you have is what I call a throwaway feminism. Okay, which is I'm not here to tell you about feminism. I'm just putting these people in this situation, and whoever's able to step up, steps the fuck up. Mm-hmm. The reason I liked Alien wasn't because of the feminist component, Alien mm-hmm. 1. It was because for one of the few times in a movie that was ostensibly a horror movie, mm-hmm. the person who lived was the person who behaved reasonably,
right. mm-hmm.
who didn't freeze when they were scared, mm-hmm. and fought, used their brain all the way through, and that was Ripley. It wasn't because she was hyper-aggressive.
Right.
She wasn't particularly masculine. My dad had a fucking crush on her, right? And I was like, Dad, shut up. I don't want to know that. But... at the end of the day, when she wins, it's because she's the most intelligent, she's yeah. the most reasonable, she's the one who understands, I cannot fight this thing directly, I have to be smart. And she played it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's my girl, holy right. crap. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There was no component of it like, oh, I'm writing a strong female right. protagonist.
Right.
No. I mean, you're right, and that's what I just remember as a kid, I remember seeing this movie called... The Eyes of Laura Mars,
yeah.
right? And it's like one of these movies that
Faye
I was like,
Dunaway,
yeah,
right?
Faye Dunaway, and what's your boy?
Damn, cinephiles
Tom, what's his name from fucking Lee? Fuck,
what, Lee Marvin? No,
No. He was in the. He played Gerard in The Fugitive.
Deputy Tommy Lee Jones.
Tommy Lee Jones, and yeah, and I was like, that's such a cool movie. That and like Little Drummer Girl came out like around the same time mm-hmm. with Diane Keaton,
yeah.
and it's like those movies always struck me as interesting because mm-hmm. it's the same thing with Terminator. I think that if Terminator is about a guy, if Sarah Connor's a guy, I think the way that when you write it, when you see movies like that, like the guys, it's something about the way this stuff is written. It's like. He becomes so aware of the danger in a way and he behaves quickly. Like, oh, we gotta change this thing in a way that I think is not right. I think that in real life, if someone from the future came, you'd be fucking tripping for a long time.
I mean, first of all, like, wait, what?
Life, you'd be like, what? The robot? No, I mean, like, if someone got shot the way he does and gets up and this, I mean, like,
and heals.
And he, you know, like, heals.
All right, we have a woman
you'd be
here.
Tripping. I think that the woman's
hold
response
on, Jeff,
to
keep
that,
your thought. Keep right. your thought, because
like,
I want
like makes that work in a way that is more palpable for the audience. Right, right. You know, like,
so we let me just say this before you keep your thought, please. Chris and I have been saying this for months. Actually, I've been saying it for years, but we've been using it a lot. Most people in this industry make it on the script that people tell them not to make.
That's true.
They also make it on the script they're most scared to make.
That's also true.
Because it's coming from here.
That's true.
Trust me on this.
Yeah.
That's true. You gotta push through. Do it for mama. Whatever your reason is that allows you to go. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm gonna add on that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't interpret that if you're fledgling.
Right.
Don't mean it doesn't mean you have to write like Matewan or or you know, I don't even know. I'm going to date myself with the references, but it doesn't have to be some deep movie about a moving emotional experience.
Well, A Quiet Place was a movie everybody told him not to make. So I'm giving
Star
you
Wars was a movie that you know George I mean? Lucas was told, "Are you high, George? Right. You better get a grip.
Right.
You better get back to that American Graffiti shit, right?" And he's like, "No, I want to make Star Wars. I really want to make this. No one's making this, George. No one's making this, George. No one's making this, George."
Yeah, but I think the story is that he wanted to do that after THX, and they said no, and then he was like, because they were like, because you don't write with feeling, and he was like, oh, all right, with feeling, here's American Graffiti, say fuck all y'all, and now I'll get to do my masterpiece.
Yeah, you know?
But the point is that it's right where your heart is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your heart could be in that kind of a movie,
mm-hmm.
but write it. Don't write it to be right. Don't write it because you think it's going to chase a trend or please someone else. Mm-hmm. Write it because, look, God damn it, this movie needs to get made.
Yeah.
This show needs to be
on
the air.
You know, it's interesting.
It's going to show your voice the most.
Right.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah. You know, last week I was having lunch with some people and Virgil Williams was there who wrote Mudbound.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that it took 8 years to get that movie made.
Right.
And he wrote that movie when he was so comfortable doing everything on...
He's already a high-level producer on TV. He TV, don't need no money.
Don't need the money.
Right.
But he said, and someone was asking him, how'd you decide to do this movie?
Right.
And he was like, it's because where my heart was. I read that book, and I was like, I have to write this.
To do it.
And what's crazy was that he was, and his agents, like he said his agents gave him like a stack of 10 books to read that they represented, and he chose that, and they were like,
why would you do this?
Yeah, why would you do that?
Right.
Why?
We only put that in as a joke.
Yeah, exactly. That's what he said. That's what he said.
Right.
And they basically were like, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And he was like, I'm going to write it on spec.
Right.
Is
right.
what his
Fuck
goal.
Y'all.
He's like, I'm going to do this on spec.
Well, you all thought I was asking you for permission.
Yes.
That's adorable.
Yes.
That's adorable.
I mean, that's not how it worked out eventually. Mm. But that's, I mean, look, and I think that's his first, I mean, it got him an Oscar nomination.
Yeah.
You know, it was his first produced movie.
Right.
And it got an Oscar nomination. And it took 8 years. And he was like, and the whole time he was like, I'm working on, you know, Criminal Minds. And he was like, Criminal Minds is cool and all for the money, but it's the same every week. And it's not like flexing what I want to say
about Paul
Giel
talks about that. Right.
Hey, look, there's no one way to anything.
Mm-hmm.
If I tell you should do something, all I'm really saying is do you, but really do
Correct.
You.
Mm-hmm.
If you're trying to staff on a show and you present a fake image of yourself, understand, unless you're an amazing freaking method actor, if they hired you based on this fake thing you presented, that's you for the duration. You better be able
better
to pull that
it.
Up every day without a break.
They will figure it out. Because
they'll be
quick.
Like, wait, that's not anything like what you said to
8 hours a day or 10 hours a day in the same
room. Hard.
Right.
You're out.
They're going to see it.
What I was going to ask
you. What's that French accent? What the fuck?
When did you become British? Oh, yeah, whatever. But. Okay, so it's three dudes and a lady. Really, these conversations ought to have a balance of
to the mic, please.
Everything, but my feeling about this whole female empowerment movement, all that kind of stuff. I want to see a woman director. I want to see it. I say that your womanness is immaterial to me. Your personness is very material to me.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened in our industry, and I think across the board in the society. Like always, people always try to separate Hollywood out. Like we're over here, and the rest of society is doing some other shit. It's all the same shit. We're all the same people.
We're in a bubble,
right? We're not in any kind of bubble. Hollywood is just people, okay? But what has happened is the personhood of women has been downgraded over course of a period of time. If you look at the 30s and 40s, women dominated motion pictures. Mm-hmm. They not only
they wrote the first scripts.
They were writing them. Yep. They were directing them. All of that stuff. United Artists, partially formed by a woman, as a response to, you are not paying me enough and I don't have enough control, so guess what, motherfucker, right? Yeah. So the women have always been there doing that stuff, and it's a cyclical thing. But in the actual product, they have been depersonized, right, made into trophies and all that kind of stuff. And backstage, what that is evidenced as oh, well, a lady can't do an action movie. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm pointing right at Kathryn Bigelow. Right. I'm literally standing next to Kathryn Bigelow. She's actually an inch taller than me.
Yeah.
Okay. You're an idiot, right? Exactly. And then you look at movies that have sold in these various arenas, and I'm like, it's your personhood. Mm-hmm. My feeling about this is about black, about gay, about femaleness, whatever is, I want everyone to have the same access. Everybody should be able to play who can play. Right. Mm-hmm. But I don't give you any special anything because you happen to share an ethnicity with me. I just want you not to be kept out because of that ethnicity. Right. Once you've got to the point where I'm seeing you, you better be a gladiator. Because a white guy's going to beat you if he beats you. Mm-hmm. That's the way I look at it. The dude's going to beat you if he beats you. If he just straight up beats you, if it's equal, you're going to get the gig.
Yeah.
Because fuck them. But not white people, just people who don't get you, don't give you the gig. But if it's they're measurably superior to you, then it isn't because you're black or gay or be whatever. Mm-hmm. I need to make my show. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be awesome. So I'm kind of weirdly disgusted by the fact that their white supremacy, their patriarchy, has forced all these people, and it's legitimate. I'm not saying it isn't the only response. It is the only response, but everybody's squatting up. Like,
the tribalism is getting real strong. Real strong.
You can't use their tactics. You can't adopt their tactics. You make yourselves into them, and then you didn't win anything by winning. You just are another version of them.
Yeah, there was an interesting art. Someone put on Twitter. I can't remember what. Some TV writer was saying that, you know, David Slack was saying that
he's the shit. I love that guy.
Mm-hmm. So if you go on, you know, he was like, "There's this is what happens." It's like he's up here saying that white male writers are being told by their agents, you're not, you didn't get that job because they wanted a woman or because they got some person of color. And it's like, and that's part of what you were saying earlier, Jeff, about like people are just the civility. It's like they can't tell you you weren't that good. So
they don't want to be the person to tell you
that. So they blame it on someone else.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to throw one of us on
the bus. Yeah. You know, and he was like, you know, and the thing is that he was saying, Slack was saying, the industry is not rigged against you if you're a white guy. It's fucking rigged for you.
Yeah, if you can't make 100%. It.
Then there's that's a you problem.
Yeah, that's all you in the gym. You better get back in the gym.
So write something else. Exactly. Don't be so like to sit on your laurels. But I think the converse thing is that if you're black or you're a woman or you fall into these categories that have to be protected because of the society has kind of been such shit. Mm. It's like you just have to write good shit in a way that it outstrips that. I mean, like, I was telling a friend of mine one time a couple years ago who was on a staff at her job. She's like, they're not treating me right. And I was like, you know what? Since you're getting an episode, right? Yeah, they have assigned it to me. You have to, like, kick everyone's fucking ass with their episode. Right. Yeah. And then they fucking go,
Five times.
I'm going to tell you guys offline what I just did.
The thing is that some people still might not like you after you order a good episode.
Yeah.
And those are the real assholes.
You know what? Don't like me, man. That's perfectly fine. Do not like me. Because you know what they're going to call? They're going to call the best assassin.
Right.
They're going to call 007. Right. They're not going to call
006. They're
going
to guarantee you your contract next year, ain't they?
Right, that's right. Right. Okay. You win by winning. And it's unfair. My dad, you just said this. I'm sure your father and parents told you this. Military, my dad is a...
Right, mine too.
As well. Mm-hmm. They're like, look, it's going to suck. There's going to be a whole bunch of shit out there that's completely unfair, and you're going to realize it, and it's completely unjust, and you're absolutely right. And you know what? So what? What can you do about it just yourself?
Yeah.
Even if you joined a movement and marched about it, what's really going to change in the day-to-day of it? You need to be undeniable. You need to be good enough at your thing that even the racist is like, yeah, we probably should hire Jeff, right? Because we want to make a lot of money,
yeah.
Right? And a lot of people can't square with that. They want it to be I don't know. They're like a 5-year-old going, that's not fair. Nope. It's, you know what my dad's response when I was 5 was?
That's not fair.
Nope. You're right.
Yeah.
So what's for dinner?
Yeah. Now what?
Straight up. Yeah. You've grasped life now, 5-year-old.
See,
this,
you know, it's interesting. There's a book. I think his name is Thomas Friedman. He wrote this book called Thank You for Being Late. Hmm. And he was talking about how what upsets a lot of white people now is that for a long time, they could just get a high school degree and be good. Mm-hmm. And now the fact that the competition is like, oh, you almost need a master's degree to be good now. Yeah. You know? And it's like,
you need a bachelor's just to be in the fucking mailroom at CAA.
Yeah. So you know,
why do they even have a mailroom?
Why do you
think? Who uses mail? Everyone's email.
To me, that's the way to weed motherfuckers out.
It's this whole thing where it's kind of like that level of like, well, you've lost that entitlement. Mm-hmm. Is upsetting to people, but it's kind of like you shouldn't have been taught that in the first place.
I'ma say what I feel, and I promise to keep it real.
Welcome to the red room. Well, you gotta be a rider till your fears are diminishing, the doubts are behind ya. It's hard to grind and the business got me stressed. In the rent room, we let that shit up off our chest. You know the street nerd has got no time for no caca. Sass in class, yes, that's Mr. Bolakaja. Never have to guess when you're listening to Hilliard. He gon' bring more game than a shark playing billiards. It's all about the crap of screenwriting. It's exciting when you turn an outline into something enlightening. Your pen and words are like bullets in a gun. Write what you feel, say what you want.
Welcome to the Red Room.